Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
You know, it's, we're getting an implant.
Oh no. That's serious. Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we pulled Sabri out of the dentist chair to make today make sense. Kai is out today, so joining me is Marketplace's Sabri Benishor. I'm sorry
Hi.
About your dental work.
I didn't realize we were on the air. Oh, my God. Well, it is very good to be back. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on this Thursday, May 9th. Today, we are going to listen back to some of the big stories of the week. So we've got some audio clips lined up for that.
Yes, our first clip is from an interview that I had with Ki Hong, who is a lawyer at the firm Skadden Arps. And I was reporting in the last couple weeks about how joint political fundraising committees work. And these are basically umbrella organizations that allow candidates and party committees and PACs and all other sorts of political entities to pool their fundraising efforts. And so rather than asking a donor individually for a donation up to whatever the contribution limit is for that type of group, which are different depending if you're a PAC or a party committee or a candidate campaign or whatever, they get themselves together and they just ask donors for one massive check, and they set up a formula that then divvies up the money to everybody who's in that umbrella organization, you know, based on their contribution limits and order of priority or whatever. And Hong, who works on the sort of corporate side, which is often people and organizations who are being asked for these massive checks, told me about sort of the side effect of the growth of these joint political fundraising committees.
The more ways there are to raise a significant amount of money, the more money is going to go into the system. That's just by nature how it works. And so this is another way of increasing the budget and the cost of elections, because you have to keep up with the other party.
Right. So these joint fundraising committees do make it easier for aligned campaigns to raise money more quickly. If you're a super rich person or organization that wants to contribute, it means that you only have to write one check instead of 50 or something like that. But it is raising the bar for how much elections cost. Hong told me that during the last federal election cycle, joint fundraising committees were asking donors for checks around like $600,000. Yes, like from one person sometimes. But now, this cycle, they're asking for checks of like $800,000 and up. And for some context, if you feel like you're hearing about this a bit more now than maybe in the past, it's because in 2014, the Supreme Court overturned what were called aggregate limits. So there used to be a limit on how much any individual could donate to political campaigns in general. So you had a cap on what you could donate. But now they're like, no, you can donate as much as you want to, as long as you follow the contribution limits for each individual group. So the more organizations you pool under one umbrella of a joint fundraising committee, the bigger the check can be. And so there's nothing really to stop, say, the Biden campaign from joining 100 different PACs and the 51 state party committees, because, yes, they count D.C., and the, you know, Democratic committee and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the convention committee and the senatorial committee and, you know, the attorney general's committee, whatever you want. They could put all those under one umbrella and ask for just a massive check.
Wow. And then they decide how to split it up.
Yeah, but it has to adhere to the individual contribution limits of, like, each individual campaign. So say it was like the Biden Victory Fund, maybe the first for presidential races. I think it's like $3,300 or something like that. So that would go there. And then maybe it would go to the DNC, whatever the limit is for the party committees. And then the individual state committees would get their allotment and on down the list according to the priority. And then PACs have their own contribution limits and they could set sort of who gets what first.
What is the advantage of doing it that way?
On the donor side, giving your money to a joint fundraising committee just saves you time, right? It means you write one check instead of 50. And if you are a smaller campaign, and this happens a lot with sort of congressional candidates, if you are in a safe district, say you're an AOC or something like that, but you're still raising a ton of money, you can put that money into a joint fundraising committee and you're still going to get up to your limit, but then that money can be redistributed to the rest of the party so that people who are in more competitive races can also get a slice of it. And that's why you have these sort of Senate leadership funds and congressional leadership funds aligned with like Steve Scalise or something like that. And that helps people who are in safe districts kind of allocate resources to folks who are in more difficult races. And under the auspices of a joint fundraising committee, you can coordinate, say, fundraising emails or ad campaigns. So maybe everybody who's under that joint fundraising committee pays into the pool for a company to come up with ads on a similar message that then get distributed across the whole network. Probably more than ever wanted to know about joint fundraising.
That's crazy. It's like a plumbing system for campaign money, like, you know, swiftly moving things all over the place.
It's another way for people who have a lot of money to give more of it in politics. And but all of that to say, small dollar donors are still giving more in these federal races than in terms of overall dollar amounts at this point than the big money donors, at least the money that we can trace.
Well, that's good to know that, like, you know, every day people still have a voice there.
I won't go as far as all that. I want to say something about that because I have thoughts. So yes, the overall volume of money from small dollar donors is greater. But if you think about who actually gets to sit in the room and be a part of the conversations and shape the policy, it still is the people who write those big checks. They're the ones showing up at the fundraising dinners. They're the ones, that get invited to the closed door meetings because they're writing the bigger checks. Somebody giving $10-$20 for a campaign is not a part of those conversations.
Okay, well, my hopes were briefly lifted and now we're back to being depressed about it again. So thank
you. You're welcome.
On to the next clip.
Chinese companies may be operating at a loss for a very long time, but are not necessarily incentivized to exit the market as would otherwise happen. You have this kind of a continual sort of excess reserve, as it were, of production, and you are incentivized to continue producing, even if the market is telling you there's no need for it.
So that was from a conversation I had with Jeffrey Goetz. He's a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. It was for a story I was working on about something the U.S. and Europe have been complaining about with regard to China, which is this thing called overcapacity. And this is the idea that China, you know, subsidizes or pumps up some of its industries so much that businesses that should be going out of business do not. And they just keep making stuff and flooding markets and undercutting, producers all over the world who, are beholden to, you know, the laws of capitalism. And particularly the U.S. and China are, or the U.S. and Europe are complaining about this taking place in green technology, like electric vehicles or batteries. Mostly it's about electric vehicles. The problem is overcapacity, making a bunch of stuff and selling your extras abroad sounds a lot like just being an exporter, you know, like if you can
you
sell
make more than you need, so you sell it abroad.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the U.S. makes a ton more soybeans than we need. Are we do we have soybean overcapacity that we should be punished for? And this is China's argument, partly as well. You know, they will make that argument, and they'll also say, you know, I know you're upset that our cars are cheaper and better, but that's just because they are. There are plenty of examples of Chinese subsidies that have pumped up their industries and given them a major advantage. And there is ongoing advantages that they get. You know, they get credit that a normal business would not. Free land, tax benefits, et cetera. All that aside, China just did better with electric vehicles. And some of them did not benefit from all these extra perks like BYD. So it's kind of a stretch on the electric
vehicles. Where is the line between a competitive advantage and an unfair advantage? Because, I mean, what we're doing with the CHIPS Act, for example, is giving incentives, giving tax credits, giving grants, giving billions of dollars in incentives to make chips here, right? And eventually, that could potentially, with all that assist, lead to an overcapacity. I mean, I think that's in an ideal world. Like, where's the where do you think you draw the line between incentivizing businesses you want to have in your country and then exporting the excess versus an unfair advantage and dumping, aka overcapacity?
Yeah, dumping has a specific definition that involves selling abroad for cheaper than the market price at home, which is even
harder. But
that's
the case with these cars, right?
No, the cars are not necessarily cheaper abroad than they are at home, I don't believe.
Oh, I see. You're saying cheaper. I understand. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. That's a really good question. And the answer is that it can really vary industry by industry, and it's very sort of data-dependent, data-driven, based on the, you know, specific things, the specific perks that are being granted. And that is why this is so tricky. It's also tricky because China's system is just so different. You know, the connection and the intermingling between the government and industry is so different on so many levels. Whether it's a fair or unfair thing, it's kind of comes down to specific either WTO rules in some cases or you know, specifically the kind of support that's being given.
Okay. All right. Moving on. Another clip. Let's go.
We believe very strongly that there has to be a dialogue and a conversation between companies that train AI models and content owners and publishers. And so this is, you know, our first step in what I think is the beginning of a dialogue as to how we think content should be managed, should be allocated, and ultimately kind of used responsibly for everyone's benefit in the age of AI.
One might argue that the first step in the conversation should have been asking to use everyone's content first, perhaps. Anyway, that was the COO of OpenAI, Brad Lightcap, on CNBC, talking about a new content tool that OpenAI is developing. The company says that this tool will allow writers, artists, and other content creators to identify their work to OpenAI and then choose whether or not they're okay with it being used to train their AI models now that the models are already trained. this comes, sorry, I'm trying to keep the sarcasm out of my voice, but they're just like, oh, yeah, we're just starting this process now that we've already scraped all of your content. And it's the beginning of a conversation now that we have all your stuff. And sure, you can ask us to take it out. It'll be fine. Trust us. Yeah. Anyway, this comes after AI companies, including OpenAI, have been accused of infringing on intellectual property rights by using works without the creator's permission to train AI models like ChatGPT. Very famously, the New York Times and others have sued them. Mm. A bunch of content creators have sued them. And there is a way already to sort of indicate on websites that you don't want your content scraped by these training models. And this is sort of an additional thing that they're saying that they're going to allow content creators to do. But at the end of the day, if you're a content creator, ourselves included, you kind of just have to trust that they'll take it out and that the system hasn't already baked in. Like, I remember our colleague Matt Levin was playing around with ChatGPT when it first rolled out and like asked it to write a story, like to read some of his work and then write a story about a thing he'd already written about in the style of himself. And it was very similar. I did a bunch of stories on like the mermaid industry, right?
Yeah.
I asked ChatGPT to write a radio story in the style of Marketplace about the mermaid industry. And it was disturbing how similar it was. And I was just like...
Did you give it your interviews to read when you did that?
No, I didn't. I intentionally did not give it. And remember, the version of ChatGPT that I was using at the time didn't have my new stories in it, right? It just had old stuff because it was like, it only had up until a certain point. And it framed it as like an interview with a host as opposed to an actual like reported story, which is what I did. Mm. But it's read like something we would have done. And I was just like, hey, there goes my job.
Well, like an artist, a writer is going to read Shakespeare and modern novels and Tolstoy, I don't know. They'll read a bunch of books and to understand the world of literature, and then they'll spit something out that is, part them and part a reaction to the world of literature in which they exist. And I feel that is kind of what, ChatGPT and all the others are doing. They're familiarizing themselves with the world of some, with one world or another, whether it's writing or painting or whatever. And then spitting something out inspired by that or influenced by that. So on the one hand, that's kind of how I see what they're doing. On the other hand, myself, I'm an artist, dabble in art on the side. And I would be
what have
horrified.
Dabble, Sabri? You do full on shows of your ceramics.
Well, I would be horrified if I saw elements of my stuff in something that ChatGPT whipped up, Claude or anything.
Midjourney or something.
Yeah, Midjourney.
But it's so already in there, right?
Oh, God. Yeah, I know. God. Yes, I know.
I'm sorry. I'm like crushing your soul right and left today. I'm sorry, Sabri. We got to move
that's
on.
Okay.
We've been on forever.
It's kind
anyway.
Of a meringue as souls go. It's fine. Easy to do. okay, but we have one last one, right?
Yeah.
The most powerful iPad ever is also the thinnest. All I ever need
is you. What was that?
I was speaking of soul crushing. That was the iPad ad. Remember? Nancy Marshall Ginzer covered that today. It was a little bit from Apple's ad for the new iPad Pro that a lot of people are heated about, because in the commercial there's this big pile of stuff that people use for creative purposes like instruments, art supplies, things like that, and it gets crushed dramatically by an industrial press. Oh my. In the end, it's being smooshed into a super thin iPad. And for obvious reasons, as we just discussed, as people are already fearful for the future of human creativity and originality, people did not like that ad, with folks commenting the ad was destructive, soulless, and represented artists' worst fears, having their artistic and cultural value replaced by a piece of technology. And on that note, because we do not want to be replaced by a piece of soulless technology, we actually need your help. And we are getting ready to start our May fundraiser. And we are human. Sabrina and I are real people. We were talking about gardening before. AI cannot garden. Well, it probably can, but not with the soul and the complaints about pesticides, about pests and spider mites and all the things that we discuss. Anyway, because people like you across the country invest in Marketplace and Make Me Smart, we're able to tell human stories behind the economic trends and with empathy, because we are actual people. Stories that have heart, and sometimes we hope a bit of humor. And some say that our sense of humor sets us apart, and that's what we have that the bots don't have yet, unless, you know, except for the AI bad jokes. So we decided to channel that sense of humor that we do have and make a shrinkflation mini tote bag for this fundraiser, because mini tote bags, all the rage. It's a public media tote bag, but smaller. 8 inches by 8 inches, about 45% smaller than a standard tote bag. If you've seen the sizes of your favorite snacks in the grocery store lately, you will get the joke. Anyway, you can get one if you invest $20 or more in Marketplace today.
And just for Make Me Smart listeners, we also made a set of 3 mini pencils, so you can participate in the mini pencil economy. You can make a donation in the amount that's right for you and pick up a thank you gift that will make you smile. Marketplace.org/givesmart, or you can follow the link in the show notes. But we appreciate it however much you give.
Yes, please and thank you. Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker, audio engineering by Juan Carlos Torrado. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Talia Menchaca is our intern.
Marissa Cabrera is our senior producer. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. And Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital.
It's a nice, chonky show today.
We are.
Because we're long-winded.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.